This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, Artie Lang, cracks people up, often by telling stories about the awful, embarrassing, depressing, self-sabotaging, even tragic things that have happened to him. He's one of the regulars on The Howard Stern Show, and a stand-up comic who is in such demand he can get more than $80,000 for a gig. Last year, Lang wrote a memoir called Too Fat to Fish. Since then, fans of The Stern Show know that Artie Lang is looking healthier, he's dropped about 45 pounds, and has a new girlfriend, though he hasn't yet brought her into the studio. Too Fat to Fish is now out in paperback, and Howard Stern wrote the introduction. He says, quote, "Artie is a complicated subject. Most people who listen to my show will ask me to explain why a guy who has everything going for him has so many issues. You know what I'm talking about. The heroin problem, the gambling, the eating, the hookers. All of it forces people to ask, how can a man with so much talent have so many problems? But here's the bottom line. Artie is the funniest, sweetest guy around, and Artie has the biggest heart on the planet." Unquote. Terry Gross spoke to Artie Lang last November.
Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hey, how you doing, Terry?
Okay. The last time you were on our show, we talked a little bit about your father, who you really looked up to, and he installed rooftop TV antennas for a living, and when you were 18, he fell off a roof and became a quadriplegic after that, and he died of complications and infections about 4 years later. That had a huge impact on you and your family. Your father had no health insurance. The homeowner had no insurance. The family went broke. Your mother went on welfare. In your new memoir, you write a little bit about your father's life before the accident, and he used to work for a bookie. And in this book, you talk about how he was addicted to the scam. And tell us, like, one of the scams that you knew about, maybe even one of the scams that he involved you in when you were a baby or a child.
A typical scam that my father really was proud of because he felt justified in it was, you know, he installed TV antennas. So in the late 70s, when I turned about 12 years old, cable television came in. And, you know, who needs an antenna? And it's cable TV. Everybody saw the writing on the wall. But early on, it was so easy to steal cable. Like, you just had to climb a telephone pole and pull one wire out, and you could get the whole block cable. And he actually taught me how to climb up a pole. And there was this special silver blocker that they would put up if you had basic cable and they wanted to block Showtime or HBO or one of the premium channels. They put this blocker up so you couldn't get them. If you paid for them, they'd take it down. So my father figured out through one of the cable guys that if you took that blocker off and boiled it in water for 20 minutes, it would render it useless. But if an inspector came by from the cable company, he would look up at the pole and he would see it was there, so it would be no problem. So my father actually asked me to climb some poles and get as many of them as I could. We then boiled like 50 of them at a time in our garage and went back to everybody on the street and said, "You have basic cable? Well, we can get you every premium channel for a price." If they agreed to that, my father and I and a couple of my buddies who we recruited, we'd run up the pole, we'd put the blocker back so the cable company could see it. And because it was boiled, it was useless. And the signal for the premium channels ran right through it and everybody got it for free.
So, you know, you write about how your father loved scams. And when you were young, you did something that was really crazy. You went into a bank inspired by the Woody Allen film, Take the Money and Run. And you wrote a note and gave it to the bank teller. And the note said,
it said, "I have a gun, put $50,000 into a bag, turn around and count to 1,000, act natural, no, act casual. Thank you for your cooperation, Artie Lang Jr." I signed it. And of course it was a joke. And I thought once the woman saw my signature, she'd figure it was a joke. The broad behind the counter, you know, teller, was cute, and I don't know, I guess I was hitting on her or flirting with her in some way, but of course I didn't realize that she never got to the end of the note. All she saw first was, "I have a gun." It was, It was like one of the stupidest things a human being could do.
So I got to ask you, what did you think the response was going to be? Like, wow, what a really funny note. Let's go out, have a drink, and then maybe make love. I mean, what did you think she was going to say?
Terry, did you get a transcript and find out exactly what the judge said to me? And my mother said to me, yeah, I figured I would hand her the note and she would look up at me and go, God, this is just the wittiest guy I've ever seen. And look at him. He has acne and a cheesy mustache and an uneven tan from the Seaside Boardwalk. Let's get married. The messed up part was I was with my girlfriend at the time. Who I write about, you know, they called us Bonnie and Clyde after that. She knew nothing about it. But yeah, she turned white as a ghost and she pressed a silent alarm. And when I saw this, I grabbed the note and I threw it out behind me in a garbage can. And
where it could be used as evidence.
Right, which was dumb because the cops came seconds after we left. My girlfriend was like, what's going on? I said, ah, nothing. We left in her mother's car, a 77 Ford Granada. That did not move. And about 2 minutes later, there were a bunch of, like a SWAT team, an armed robbery call went out, and we just missed that, and they found the note and gave it to the judge, and he read it back to me a million times. That was dumb.
The name of your book and the name of your company is Too Fat to Fish, which is how your mother once described you after you told her when you were much younger, before you were full-time comic, when you told her that your foreman had invited you to go fishing. So when she told you that you were too fat to fish, what did she mean and why did that stick with you all these years?
Well, at the time I was a longshoreman. I was working at the port in Newark unloading ships, and I had never been fishing before. And the weird thing is I wasn't really fat at all. I certainly not compared to what I am now. I mean, at some point in the last few years, I became Dom DeLuise. but back then, I was about 22 years old. I'd only done stand-up a few times, and I was working at the port. And I just never had showed an interest in anything. Like, that's the best way to describe it. I never, had hobbies except, I played baseball and I was sarcastic. Like, that's the only interest.
That's a great hobby.
Yeah. So fishing or anything like that was just, my mother would never expect me to come close to even doing something like that. But at the time I said, hey, I might be a longshoreman forever. I didn't have a lot of real, good future plans at that point. And my foreman said, hey, it was a Friday afternoon. He said, hey, I'm going fishing tomorrow at 5 a.m. Do you want to come fishing? And I said, yeah, and we went out to happy hour as we did every Friday and got blind drunk. And he left at about 9 and he said, okay, I'll be there to pick you up tomorrow. I'll be there at like 6. And, I gave him that drunk promise. Yeah, I'll be there, I drank till about 3. I went to White Castle's and had about 15 double cheeseburgers and a chocolate shake. And then I went home and sure enough, at 6, the phone rings and it's him. And I got up, threw some water on my face and I went downstairs. And my mother, who is a lunatic, was up vacuuming. And she, would vacuum early in the morning because no one was up to bother her. Very sort of Italian, ultra clean woman. And she noticed me up on a Saturday at 6, which was crazy. So she stopped vacuuming and she calmly said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going fishing. And she had a look on her face like I told her I was going to the moon to, get some samples for NASA. And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going fishing. And she said, with who? I said, the foreman, we're going out for tuna, deep sea fishing. So I guess all of her mother instincts told her that she figured I would die on the boat. And because she didn't want that to happen, she thought of anything to tell me to keep me from going. And she just screamed, you are too fat to fish, at the top of her lungs. She must have said it about 30 straight times. She woke up the neighbor. She woke up my sister who was sleeping upstairs. And at the time, she didn't realize how funny that phrase sounded, too fat to fish. But, she wouldn't let me go. So I had to call the foreman. Now, I'm 22 years old. I said, listen, I can't go fishing. He's like, why? I said, my mother won't let me. And he was Italian. He sort of got it. he accepted that, and I went back to sleep, and I slept till 4 p.m. I woke up. My mother made me a mozzarella omelet with roasted peppers and some Bonnell bread toasted, and I had the greatest breakfast slash late lunch. And while we were eating, my sister was there, and I said to my mother, I said, Ma, do you realize how funny and ridiculous you sounded this morning? She goes, what are you talking about? I said, you said I was too fat to fish like 40 straight times, and Stacy, my sister, was laughing, and finally we got her to think it was funny. She saw the humor in it.
Someone described you, and I can't remember if it was somebody from the Howard Stern Show or someone else who knows you, described you as, you know, although you're so lively on the air and so funny on the air and on the stage, that put you, say, in a party, you're likely to be in a corner and quiet. Is that true?
Yeah, Howard brings that up. I don't know. There's, you know what? Here's the thing with me. Like, liquor will amplify whatever mood I'm in. If I'm in a really good mood, booze will make me even funner and crazier and happy. If I'm in a bad or depressed mood, I will get dark, you know, and I'll look like, you know, Edgar Allan Poe after, you know, he lost his fourth wife to tuberculosis. I just have a very dark side in me, and I'm basically depressed. I don't really enjoy my company, and I can't get away from myself. I'm bored to death with my life right now, bored to tears. And I don't know what to do. I need some sort of, that's why I like getting high and gambling. Cause it's something to look forward to. I have the greatest job in the world, but I'm just so bored.
Why are you bored? I mean, being on the Howard Stern Show sounds like it would be just like constantly interesting, constantly keeping you on your toes with like incredibly good feedback. So why do you think you're bored?
I don't know. I mean, it's for a shrink to say. I'm just bored to death. I hate working. I've always hated working. I hate having to be somewhere. I hate long-term commitments on any level. I can remember being...
I guess your girlfriends learned that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, not even that so much. It's even work. Like, I can remember being in the second grade, and literally, I can remember saying to myself, God, in 5 years, I'll only be in the seventh grade. School is going to take forever. When is this going to end? I don't want to be here. I want to quit. I hate having to be here. And for years, I struggled to get onto a television show. And then when I got on Mad TV, I signed a five-year contract. I was 27, and I can remember going, oh, you know, I'll be here till I'm 32. My life is over. I want this to end tomorrow. And subconsciously, I think I destroyed it, those things. You know, I got thrown off of Mad TV after the second year because of coke, and maybe that's because I really wanted to. I don't know. I was on a sitcom for 2 years. I had a job that people in this business would absolutely kill for on the sitcom I was on. I was working with one of my best friends. Laurie Metcalf was in the cast, like really talented people on the Warner Brothers lot in L.A. I was a supporting character making $35,000 a week. Some weeks I'd have two lines. I had a job making $35,000 a week, and I didn't have to take anything to work. I didn't have a briefcase or a piece of paper. I had ridiculously lame, easy jokes to memorize. Like the jokes on that show would be, I'd go to Norm MacDonald. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? And he'd say, no, I'm not thinking of cheeseburgers. And then I'd make a face like, oh, you got me, you know. And then I'd walk out, and then I'd get $35,000 on a Friday. So I had a convertible Mercedes. I was living in a $4,000 a month condo on Wilshire in Beverly Hills. And, I mean, I was healthy. I was thin. I had a tan. Even with that life, creatively, I was empty inside. You know, even with that life, I couldn't stand it. After 2 years, I had to get out of there. I was pulling the hair out of my head. And then
So let me ask you, if you're bored now, and you've been bored at some of the most successful and well-paid periods of your life, what is it that you like to do when you're not working, if you hate working? Like, do you want to stay at home and watch TV all day? Is that what you'd want to do?
Well, it's a dark answer, but I'll be totally honest with you. I want to do, you know, heroin. When I was in my 20s, my life became chaos because of cocaine. And, you know, I was younger. Cocaine's a social drug.
And this was after your father died. Much
after. Yeah. My father was not a drug guy. As a matter of fact, my father used to tell me another word for gambler is loser, you know. He had none of the vices I have, and he would be really upset if he knew what I've thrown my money away on. But as I've gotten older, I withdraw more and more from life. And I got into opiates on the road, and opiates are the direct opposite of cocaine. Opiates are, you know, you want to be mellow and just hang out, be alone and not off, you know. My entire adult life, I have done drugs and I've drank, so that's all I know how to do. Charlie Parker, the legendary saxophonist who, you know, is a legendary junkie too. I think he died. He was 34. He got out of rehab once, and when he relapsed, he said, you know, they can get it out of your blood, but they can't get it out of your head, you know. So right now, it's out of my blood. I went through the withdrawals, but it's still in my head. I can remember how great it was to just come home and get high and not deal with anything. But, you know, with a schedule as regimented as I have, I you know, get up at 4:30 and I get to work at 6, and I work 6 to 11 on a big radio show where you got to be sort of on. And then on the weekends, I become nocturnal. I'm up all night doing stand-up. With that kind of schedule, heroin is going to really, really ruin your life, you know, and it started to.
You were in rehab in August, I think you went into rehab.
Yeah, I went into like this outpatient rehab. I was there overnight and then was released under the care of a therapist. So I'm clean for the last few months, but a lot of people in my life think the outpatient rehab wasn't even scratching the surface of what I need. And, you know, they're probably right.
When you're in therapy, I mean, you are such a good talker. You can tell any story, and you could probably talk your way around anything. But when a therapist is trying to get you to kind of, you know, penetrate to your core and be really honest, sometimes it's probably tempting to, like, just tell captivating and funny stories and act like you're really penetrating, but just tell a great story. Do you know what I'm saying? So does your ability to really talk help in therapy, or does it sometimes stand in the way of, you know, actually doing the work?
That's actually an excellent question. And you know what? To be honest with you, I think it hurts completely, because there's times where I could just completely BS, you know, whatever, go off on a tangent that sounds interesting, but it's completely false and has nothing to do with what he's probably trying to get at. Might sound like it is, but it's not. And it's a way for me to avoid talking about it. And I guess everyone who knows anything about therapy, they tell you that if you're not being honest with them, you're not going to get any help. You're wasting your time. It has never been effective for me, therapy. This is the longest I've tried it. I go the first couple times, I spill my heart out, I talk about my father, whatever. And then by the third time, it's just me and some dude in the room, and I'm talking about my feelings. It's kind of fruity, to tell you the truth. I get uncomfortable, and then I start to go off on tangents, and, you know, I'm not being honest with the guy. There's God only, because I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know. I wish I could tell him. I don't know. I get the blues. I get the blues a lot, and it was before my father fell. I was like that. You know, I don't know.
So. What's the difference between how you talk on, you know, Howard Stern, and how you talk in the therapy office? I mean, are the stories any different? Or are they?
There is no difference.
Because it's not like you're not revealing on Howard's show. I mean, you're pretty out there in what you'll talk about in terms of your private
That's
life.
That's my problem. Yeah, exactly. That's my problem.
That your business is already out there.
Right. I mean, I consider the Stern show therapy. I always have. And there's been times in the last, you know, I've been on there close to 8 years now, and there's been times I leave the show and I'm walking down Sixth Avenue in a daze, going, "What did I just talk about?" You know, you realize how many people are actually listening. You're just in that room having a conversation with Howard, and you know, he can lull you to sleep, and you forget you're talking to millions of people. And you know, that's another very perceptive thing on your part, Terry. I'm telling you, the only difference sometimes between The Stern Show and me in therapy is when I'm talking in therapy, there's no one playing like a fart sound effect behind me. You know, that's about it. And if Fred Nars could come to some of the therapy sessions and do that, I think it'd be great. I'd be more comfortable.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, and back with more of Terry's 2008 interview with Artie Lang. Lang is a cast member of The Howard Stern Show and is most famous for telling incredibly funny stories describing how miserable and depressing his life is. And he's not making up the problems. He's usually very overweight and, at times, has been addicted to cocaine, heroin, and alcohol. He has a gambling problem, too, and his love life usually is in shambles. However, since this interview was recorded, he's lost some weight and gained a girlfriend. His new memoir, now out in paperback, is called Too Fat to Fish.
I've got to ask you about what was probably one of the most upsetting but also memorable moments in the history of the Howard Stern Show. And this was last April when you walked out, basically quit, after it was just like a really upsetting incident. You and your assistant Teddy were on the air with everybody else on the show. And then he started talking with you about, you know, money and said that, you know, you said you were always loaning him money and you're so generous to him. And then he said that he's always having to ask you for the money that you promised to loan him. And you were getting increasingly angrier with him. And this erupted into this huge fight about competence and money. It got really ugly. And when I say fight, I mean fight. And so we have a very brief excerpt of that that we're going to play. And in this excerpt, Teddy speaks first.
Yes, you do. Promise me money. You promise me money.
No, I don't.
Yes,
promise
you do.
You're
always like, I'll give you money on Monday. And then don't give me money on Monday.
I give you money all the time.
$500 in front of me. I need that $500.
All right, you always get it. You always get that money.
And then I have to prod and poke you for it. And I hate doing that.
But Artie, it's not your paycheck. But
I'm not doing these little
prod and poke me for money.
But
Artie doesn't.
Half the paycheck isn't in the.
Artie, I got to take umbrage with you for one thing.
Howard, you're being wrong.
Can I tell you why
you're being wrong?
Why
you're coddling him.
No, I'm not. I'm going to tell you something.
Whatever.
Hear my point of view.
Really.
No, I hate you, Ted.
Yeah.
Wow, I mean that just like stops you dead in your tracks. Artie, what went through your mind? Like, tell us what was happening at that moment from your point of view?
My publicist said you would not bring this up, so this interview's over. Just kidding.
Oh, okay. You had me there.
I haven't talked to my publicist in months. Listen, that's embarrassing. That tape is not defensible. Teddy screwed up. You know, what can I tell you? He forced me to throw something at him, and he's apologized, and, you know, we can move on now.
Is that how you see it, that he forced you to throw something
no,
at him?
No.
Okay,
no,
all right.
No. Listen, I am not well. I'm a disturbed person. I'm a maniac. I'm on drugs. I'm not stable. And Teddy works for me, you know. I don't know. I mean, what can I say? I got mad, and I don't think, you know, I do love the kid. I love the kid like a younger brother. We've worked together for a while now. We've been through a lot of, you know, trenches together, and he's been with me all over the country. So I don't think I would have hit him if I got to him, but I was just really mad. The money thing was nobody's business. I wouldn't have done anything.
You know, most of us have our darkest moments in private. You know, and when we get into a real fight, there aren't microphones around. We're not live on the air. And, you know, I think for most people who are performers or who are in front of a microphone, you kind of, you know, you behave in a certain way. You, even if you're depressed, you maybe put on a good face or something. And to have that exposed live on the air, as so much gets exposed live on Howard's show, I mean, well, what's that like for you to listen back to yourself that way? Most of us don't get a chance to, not that we'd necessarily want to. Most of us aren't in the position where we're going to be listening back to how we sounded when we blew up at people who we really love.
Yeah. Well, when I hear it back, I say, God, I wish I would have hit him because I probably would have got a bigger advance for the book. Listen, Tara, I don't know what to tell you. It's depressing. I have been in a very bad way mentally since 1985. I'm trying to figure something out here about, you know, it's
See,
funny.
I always
everyone
feel guilty
always...
laughing because, you know, it's like, no. Let me just say, like, you're so depressed. You're in such bad shape and you managed to make it funny. And I laugh and everybody around America laughs. So does that make it better or worse for you?
Well, it's laughing is better than them booing. You know, because I'm depressed. Boo. That would really suck.
Or I'm depressed. Who cares?
Yeah. Well, ultimately, but that's the thing. That's a depressing thing. Ultimately, they laugh, but then really, who cares? You know, it's like everybody's got to deal with their own stuff.
Let me get back to the Howard Stern clip that we played.
I love how most people come on shows and they play a clip of their Academy Award winning movie. Let's hear a little. We're here with Celine Dion. Let's hear a little bit of her new single off the Sisterhood of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood soundtrack. Celine, this is a wonderful song. Listen to this. And with me, you're playing a clip where I almost killed my assistant in a rage. So go ahead, Tara. Let's finish up on that.
Okay, here's the last question about it. I know on our show, when something goes terribly wrong, I'm thinking, well, this is terribly wrong. It might be really embarrassing. But it's kind of good radio because there's some drama here. People aren't going to be tuning out as this thing goes terribly wrong. Was there any part of your mind, or do you think was there any part of Howard or Robin's mind that was thinking, this is really horrible, this is really frightening, this is incredible radio?
Of course. Well, I wasn't thinking it because I was so out of my mind.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I thought it, but make no mistake, Howard thinks it 100% of the time. And they were nice, though, at Sirius and at On Demand TV. They refused to play that clip for 3 entire hours. And then after the 3 hours were over, they like made it promos, like, special, Artie loses it. We didn't play this for 3 hours because we have some dignity. But we hear, 3 hours have gone by and Artie says he's fine. So tune in. Artie loses it and almost dies.
What a predicament to be in.
What am I going to do? You know what? It's a business.
One of the things you write about in your book is that you went to Afghanistan just a few months ago, really, to do a USO tour. And why did you want to do that? I mean, you're not the most political person in the world.
I am nothing if not compassionate, however, for our men and women over there in Afghanistan and Iraq, of course. I knew a couple of comedians who had done it, and that inspired me. I put it out there on the air. I said I want to do this. I had my agent who had helped other comics get over there. I had him call for me, and there was a lot of resistance. At first, they said no, and I mentioned it on the air, and the power of the Stern Show, they came back, and they said, you know what? We ran it by some of the troops, and they would love to see Artie, so not only are we going to let him come over, we're going to give him his own tour. He can pick a few other comics. He'll be the headliner and bring a friend or whatever, and you'll have a week. The shows went amazing, and it's probably the most important thing I've ever done in my career. Like, we did some shows, since we weren't unbelievably famous people, they put us in more dangerous situations, I think. We did one show for a total of 40 guys. We had to take a Black Hawk helicopter to this remote base outside of Bagram, and these guys had just been out doing all these special ops. God knows what they were doing fighting the Taliban. They couldn't give us specifics. But they just got back at like 4 p.m, a scorching sun. They took their helmets off and they put their gear down. And 40 of them sat in front of this little makeshift stage. And they were just so happy to see anybody who wasn't military. They were hugging us and taking pictures. And we did a good hour and a half stand-up show. And, you know, as a headliner, I went last. And I always did about a half an hour. And when these guys laughed, it was so refreshing. It was so rewarding to see these guys with cuts on them and, like, you know, dirt from whatever they were doing, risking their lives for, I don't know, I hope something that turns out to be a very important cause. To see them truly get a belly laugh and maybe for that second forget about the hell they're in was just the most important thing I've ever done, you know, and the most rewarding thing I've ever done. The negative part of it is I got to know personally about 20 soldiers. I exchanged information with them, phone numbers and stuff, email. And a couple of them since I got back have been to New York, and I gave them a tour of the Sirius studios. I took them to a Yankee game, bought them lunch. And a lot of them are still over there. And the problem is I don't have friends or relatives over there, thank God. But now I got to know these guys, and it really puts a face on it for me. And I know their stories. A couple of them I sat next to on a military flight for, you know, 11 hours. And if one of those guys gets hurt or killed, God forbid.
Well, you were under mortar fire in one of the places on this tour. And it's the first time you were ever under attack like that. What surprised you about yourself and how you handled it? Anything?
Right. Well, what happened was we did an outdoor show in Kandahar, and we were supposed to go to the meet and greet, and we had to get in all these big military SUVs to drive to the meet and greet. And during the drive after the show to the meet and greet, it was like out of a movie. Incoming, you know, take cover. So the guy driving our car, the Marine, pulled into this driveway next to these bunkers. They told us to stand still until they came around. They opened up the door, and a bunch of Marines formed a shield, like a human shield around us with their M16s out, and walked us to the bunker. And the Marines were very calm, like it was an everyday thing, and that made us calm. And we had these, you know, heroic men and women in front of us protecting us. So we were a little more casual about it. But it's funny. A lot of the guys over there did like these subtle fat jokes. I think that was their way of bonding with me. And I said to the one kid, I said, should we be more scared right now? Because it seems kind of casual. And the kid said to me, he goes, Art, listen, this is the way I look at it. If one of these things hits you, you're just going to be a pile of dust. And I said, really? And then he said, you're going to be a big pile of dust, but you'll just be dust. You know? And I'm like, you know, of course, everyone else is laughing, and I got a fake laugh. What am I going to do, say the guy's not funny? He's protecting me. And I said, oh, okay. He goes, so you'll never feel a thing, you know. And then he said, but if something comes near you, and he was dead serious, me and my buddy, we'll take the bullet. And he was dead serious. He goes, we'll get in front of you. And the more I thought about it, I felt like saying, look, don't do that, man, because believe me, you're way more important to the planet right now than I am. I said, don't take the bullet. Let me take the bullet, dude. The world needs you way more than it needs me. You're a soldier. You're young. You know, I think he had a kid, too. I'm like, I'll take the bullet. I would hate for his family to get a letter from the USO like, yeah, your son died in combat guarding someone. He took a bullet. And, you know, the family calling and saying, was it a medic? Was it a high officer? Was it someone, you know, there for peace, a priest? And the guy goes, no, actually, it was the fat guy from Howard Stern. That's who he died saving. That would have been a rough phone call.
Well, Artie, I really want to wish you the best in all ways. And thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air and talking with us. And I wish you good health and good moods and some happiness. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tara, and I'll see you at the NPR and / Sirius Christmas party, I guess. We'll do some Alabama Slammer shots with Martha Stewart and the crew. I don't know if you met them. They're a fun bunch.
Yeah, and I have a reputation for always partying hard, so.
All right, Tara, you get a haircut and stay in school, sweetie.
Okay, be well. Thank you.
Artie Lang of The Howard Stern Show, speaking to Terry Gross last November. His memoir, Too Fat to Fish, has just come out in paperback. Denzel Washington and John Travolta have teamed up to make a new film based on an old one, the 1974 action movie, The Taking of Pelham 123. Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Hollywood has remade another old movie, The Taking of Pelham 123, and dishonored its memory. That's not to say the 1974 original was a masterpiece. Joseph Sargent's New York subway hijacking thriller was broad and artless and pushed its ethnic characters in your face, as if to say, what makes New York, New York, is we play our stereotypes to the hilt. Still, a lot of people, including me, remember it with affection. It was of its era. Pelham was filmed in the streets and tunnels of the city at its dirtiest and most anarchic, and the mixture of ethnic humor and cold killing was somehow apt. The script was written by Peter Stone, whose background was in comedy, and this was a New York Jewish comedy writer's take on his beloved metropolis going scary crazy, Meshuggah. Taking on Robert Shaw's icy, blue-eyed English hijacker was Walter Matthau as a transit cop at his most rumpled and unflappable. Our hero walked through the melee, trying to tamp down the insanity, and managed to save the day without firing a shot. The remake, directed by Tony Scott, is not bad. It's slickly made, and the actors are the best money can buy. But even with its rat-a-tat syncopated aerial shots of the New York skyline, there's little sense of place. It could as easily have been shot in Toronto. The chief hijacker, called Ryder, is played by John Travolta with tattoos and a Fu Manchu mustache. He's not a terrorist. That would at least have been timely. He's just another movie-ish, extroverted sociopath greedhead. Where Robert Shaw was clipped and spooky, Travolta talks your head off. The good guy, Garber, is the quiet one, and Denzel Washington wears glasses and affects a humble manner. Garber had worked his way up in the transit system, but is under investigation for taking bribes. Demoted to dispatcher, he makes first contact with the hijackers.
Pelham 123 to Rail Control Center, do you read me?
Yes, I read you, Pelham 123. This is Control Center. Who is this?
It's me, man. I didn't want to call till everything was ready.
I understand, Pelham 123. Who the hell is this?
This is the man who's going to rock the city. This is the man who's going to give the city a run for the money. Now look up. Look up at your screen. You tell me what you see. You see what I've done?
I see it.
One car is much more manageable than 10 with the manpower I got. Mr. Motorman's going to tell you all about it. Tell him what we got here.
They got hostages, lots of them, and they got machine guns.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you check me. You understand that?
I check. I understand.
The subway car is stopped dead, and Washington is at his desk for most of the film. Yet director Scott keeps the taking of Pelham 123 in constant motion. The camera circles counterclockwise around Washington. Then it circles clockwise. Then it's back to counterclockwise, this time jumping to close-up. Then it's clockwise again, tighter, the beads of sweat on Washington's brow reflecting the periwinkle blue of the subway command center's monitors, which also tie in nicely with the blue of hostage negotiator John Turturro's shirt and the aquamarine lights of the underground tunnel, dispersed by water droplets on the train car's windows. Scott clearly doesn't care about locations. He cares about color coordination and meaningless camera movement. There's a great setup for a timely gag when the gunman bursts into a train car and a young woman doesn't hear because she's listening to her iPod. I can think of 5 possible payoffs, but Scott just drops it and moves on. He has the filmmaker's equivalent of a neurological condition. When he cuts to a new shot, he can't seem to remember the last one. His condition must have been contagious, since writer Brian Helgeland introduces and drops enough plot points to make another movie. The mayor, played with slippery charm by James Gandolfini, susses out the hijacker's underlying scheme and rushes off to save the day. And that's the last we hear of his plan. A passenger's laptop sends out images of the captors, who don't realize they're on camera. But nothing comes of that. The movie ends with a conventional chase through the city, by which time nothing seems at stake. Throughout, Ryder has expressed fatalistic indifference over whether he lives or dies, which is supposed to give him an existentialist cool, but ends up reinforcing the so-what vibe. Travolta really looks as if he doesn't care, and why should he? Like everyone else behind this soulless remake, he got his money up front.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, some thoughts on today's transition from analog to digital TV. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for Fresh Air. I teach TV history at Rowan University. And today, right now, all over the country, TV history is being made. It started this morning and is supposed to conclude by midnight, the switch from analog to digital television transmission. The new TVs you bought in the past few years, the ones with digital tuners or analog to digital converters, will have access to high-def images and maybe even a whole range of new channels. If your TV gets its programming from a cable or satellite company, things should stay pretty much the same. But if you're one of the estimated 20 million households getting its TV signals exclusively over the air, and you don't have a digital set or converter, today you enter the new dark ages. And today, as those analog-to-digital switches are flipped by local TV stations across the country, we lose one more clear connection to our past. Until today, anyone tuning on an old-fashioned analog TV set and scanning the dial could find programming the same way as when networks started broadcasting after World War II. Signals were broadcast over the air by local stations, and the stronger the signal where you lived, the better the sound and picture. If there were mountains in the way or tall buildings, it got trickier, which is why we got cable TV in the first place. But for more than 60 years, no matter what improvements and alternatives have hit the TV landscape, the same basic over-the-air distribution system has remained in place. A few years ago, I restored my father's old first TV set. It was a Raytheon, a 1947 model with a round screen, and with horizontal and vertical control knobs in front to help lock in the picture. My dad would have been 24 when he got that set. The next year, 1948, he watched Milton Berle on Texaco Star Theater and Ed Sullivan on Toast of the Town. I know, because we talked about it. A generation later, I watched a different black-and-white TV. I was in my 20s before I learned that when Dorothy got to Oz, everything switched to color. But it was the same analog system of delivery, even though the UHF, or ultra-high-frequency spectrum, had been added to provide a few more options. My son is now the age my father was when he got his first television set. Just as I was part of the first true TV generation, when television was in the house from the start, young people today grew up with cable. Today's kids don't even think of TV as broadcast or cable. CBS and NBC are just other choices on their on-screen menus, no different from Nickelodeon or Comedy Central. But they are different, or used to be, until today. Before today, if you tuned an analog television set to your local public TV station, you heard this. But tune to the same station using the same set tomorrow morning, and you'll hear this. The reason for this change is the same reason for all the changes on TV these days. Economics. The VHF frequency used until today by broadcast television is like the middle of a river. It's where things flow the most smoothly with the fewest barriers. The government has sold that part of the public airwaves for some $20 billion to such eager buyers as Verizon and AT&T. They, in turn, will use it to provide more reliable and faster service for the next generation of mobile broadband phones and portable devices. So, in theory, we'll soon have six times as many digital channels as we once had analog channels, and more gadget-packed phones as well. But using history as our guide, here's the downside. Just because a new technology opens up the potential for a wider spectrum of diversity doesn't mean it will happen. FM radio was supposed to free up the airwaves in the 60s, and cable TV was supposed to bring us channels dedicated to opera, jazz, anything anyone wanted. But most broadcasters chased after the same fat pieces of the pie, rather than produce expensive programs for limited audiences. Why, with digital channels, should any of that change? But the biggest worry, to me, is the elitist underbelly of all this. One of the most noble and encouraging developments in all of TV history has been public television, with its electronic head start given to poor children in poor communities. If they had a TV set at home, no matter how small or how old it was, they could tune to Sesame Street or Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and start to learn. But after today, if those families haven't converted to digital TV, and lower-income households are the most likely not to, their television sets no longer will be brought to them by the letter T or V, much less TV. If Marie Antoinette were a member of the FCC, she'd have no problem with this. I can hear her now. Let them eat cable.
Now, what starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie.